Welcome to Impact, the Conservation Photography Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Heimbuch. And if you are a visual storyteller with a love for all things wild, then you're in the right place. From conservation to creativity, from business to marketing, and everything in between, this podcast is for you, the conservation visual storyteller who is ready to make an impact. Let's dive in. Hey there, and welcome to this episode of Impact, the Conservation Photography Podcast. And this is a special encore episode. See, we have been so lucky to hear from incredible people over the years, from professional photographers to photo editors to business people to filmmakers, all kinds of folks who are filled with knowledge and experience and information and insights that helps us in our own individual journeys as conservation photographers. And I wanted to roll out an episode that is a fan favorite with information that helps you all the way from the very start of your journey into conservation photography, all the way through to running a successful business. And just these beautiful golden nugget insights that can help you no matter what stage of the journey you're on now or where you're headed next. So please enjoy an episode that is filled with highlights from several of the most loved interviews that we've had on the show so far. You are sure to walk away with so many little insights that are going to speed you along, that will inspire you, that will put a smile on your face. So let's dive in. Here is Carla Rhodes from episode 31.
It was one of these moments in my life that I look back on and will my whole life and be like, my life changed, because we pull into this landfill and I see this endangered bird scavenging. Alongside of the bird, there's people scavenging. There's cows, there's wild dogs, and there's trash taller than buildings. And not only that, is this landfill is eating a Ramsar protected wetland. So at that moment, I just said to myself, you know, this whole time I've been pursuing wildlife photography, I'm like, my work has to make a difference. I want to be a wildlife conservation photographer. I'm getting kind of chills thinking about it, because it's one of the few moments in my life where I'm like, my whole life changed. And I just became so obsessed with the story and that moment. It moved me to tears. It actually changed my whole view on life. I'm not exaggerating, because there were also, you know, there's people that live in this landfill, and there were kids smiling and playing, and it reminded me of just the resilience of the human spirit as well. It was heartbreaking but inspiring at the same time, and that's really why I became just completely obsessed with the story. People say when you go to India that it changes you. And I thought it was a cliche. I'm pretty cynical and sarcastic, you know, and have a very good sense of humor. So I just thought, oh, that's just such a cliche thing. But literally the day before I left India, it changed my whole entire life. It's pretty crazy to talk about it and think about it now, a few years later. And I started to research, how will I get back to India? Like, how am I going to photograph this bird? And I started Googling it, and, you know, compared to like rhinos and tigers and elephants and all these endangered animals you hear so much about, like the stork is the most endangered bird in the world. And there's very little coverage on it. Not most endangered bird, most endangered stork in the world. And so I came across the National Geographic Early Career Grant, and I just read through it. And I just thought, this is a really perfect fit for this project. It was closing in a few weeks. And, you know, I'm like, this is way too much to apply for in a few weeks. So I made it my goal to complete an application for it. And I missed two cycles because I didn't have the info I needed. And I kept telling myself to wait. And I'm glad I did wait to apply for it. But I eventually was able to apply for the October 2019 cycle. So I did. I got the application finished. Huge application. I mean, to me at least. So that's how I did it. I just jumped into it and did it. I've had a pretty interesting, varied life. And what life has taught me is, I mean, a few things. One of the worst things that can happen if you go for something is, you know, someone's going to tell you no, they're going to shut the door in your face or you're going to fail. But really, the worst thing that can happen in life is that the very worst thing is that you can die, right? But when you put that up to the level of applying to an application, someone can say no. Saying no really pales into comparison on the worst thing that can happen, right? So that's kind of my mindset with these things. And to me, even if someone says no, I can learn a lot in the process. You never really know where life is going to take you through these processes. So that was a big mindset in applying for it. And I also thought, you know, I believed in the idea so much, and I still do, that it's a really interesting, powerful story that pushed me forward as well. When you take on stuff like this, I've seen this in other parts of my life as well. And I think, you know, you'll agree. Sometimes when you take on projects, you don't really realize what you're doing at the time. And it's until you're out of it that you're kind of like, whoa, right? Because India, just going to India is intense. Any American will tell you that. And if I thought too much about going, I might have resisted. There's so many lessons. Again, like I learned so many things on this trip. I think I learned as a conservation photographer that it's so incredibly fulfilling to do a style of photography that you know is for the greater good. I think that helped me overcome 90% of the challenges that I had, because I strongly feel like with the art form of conservation photography that your images can be powerful. And for me, like if one person looks at the image and they learn about that stork, then great, I've done my job. I want them to feel something for the stork. But I think the biggest problem with this bird is a lot of people don't know about it. So, I mean, the biggest lesson was that following your passion can really help push things forward for the greater good. That, you know, this project, yes, it's about me and developing as a photographer, and I hope the images get published and blah, 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 blah. But at the end of the day, it's such a great feeling to know that ultimately the work is to push forward a cause and to help give a voice to a creature that doesn't have a voice, if that makes sense.
Here is Mike Forsberg from episode 24.
That's really what we're trying to do, I think, isn't it, in the conservation world and in conservation photography in general, is, you know, we're only as powerful as what our voices are together. We need every single person's voice, because every single one of us has a different perspective. The patent answer that I have is to look in your backyard. You know, I mean, that's find the polar bear in your backyard sort of thing. What is it that you really, really care about and that you have access to, that you can get at, go to, spend time with on a very regular basis, over and over again, so that you begin to get into the rhythm of whatever it is that you're trying to pursue. And I think that's my answer. And that's also what it has played itself out really well in so many people that I know that are colleagues of mine or contemporaries, but even more so in the young people since we've been talking about the Platte Basin time lapse project. I mean, we have three graduate students in our program. We have a number of undergraduate interns. It's all through, you know, in partnership with the University of Nebraska. And each of our graduate students, they have selected a story that they're going to tell as their graduate work that takes place over time on the land. And you know, each one of them has selected something that is in most cases, very close to home that they can get access to, or if it's a little further away, it's a place that they can go to again and again and again and again, and really dig in. And by doing that, you do gain the confidence because you get to know it really well. You get to know these places, these creatures. You also get to know the people that are there. So it's really, really important that you pick something that you really care about. Because if you pick something that you don't care about, you're going to hate yourself halfway through it. You know, it's not going to be worth doing. And secondly, you got to be able to have access to it. So I've seen lots of really great young photographers that have gone all over the world and have brought back beautiful pictures from Antarctica and from Africa and from Iceland and from, you know, Alaska and all these places. But the most compelling work that I see that they show me is not from those places. It's from the places where they live, the places where they grew up, or in the category, the topic or whatever that they care most passionately about. You know, it's photograph what you know. It's just like, you know, Michener's old quote about writing, write what you know. You know, and that may not seem as sexy right out of the shoot, but if you do things locally, if you're doing them locally, you're going to build community around the work that you're doing, and you're going to get people that are going to start rooting for you. They're going to help you. They may even fund you, and you are going to be able to see the difference that you're making. Whereas if you were trying to work halfway around the world at a young age with limited resources, you may never see that. So I don't try to discourage anybody from going out and spreading your wings and going wherever life takes you. But man, work close to home because you'll have impact there too. Real impact.
Here is Clay Bolt from episode 8.
For example, if you're working on a local issue, you know, like doing things like writing op-eds are really important. Like, you know, getting your cause out in front of the people who are going to make a difference, you know, like that's one way you can do it. I also feel that, and I feel like if it's a more local issue, had I lived, for example, in North Malacca, I would have started locally, right, to try to make a difference. But I feel like the other side of the coin is, for example, when I was trying to do this work to influence the Indonesian government, I wanted it to be the story to be appearing in the best papers. I wanted the best reporters to be writing the story so that, don't take my word for it kind of thing. Like, here is a well-known story, a well-known paper, a well-known publication that is bringing attention to something that you didn't maybe pay very much attention to or whatever you want to say. But it's really awesome, and shouldn't you celebrate this? So I think for me, like, I just base it off of what I want to accomplish, and I take that approach. It's not always the biggest newspaper that matters the most. It's more about what the reach of that newspaper is. You know, knowing your audience is so darn important. Like, and one thing I've learned, I'm actually going through a graduate certificate course right now at Colorado State. Communications for conservation. And one of the things I've really thought about a lot more is, you know, not saying educate the general public is my goal. Like, that's great, but it doesn't really, at the end of the day, like, educating the public is not necessarily shown to have a huge impact. But what does have an impact is bringing a story to the right kind of people that have the power to make a difference. And yeah, it's great if everybody else gets excited, but you really want to make sure first and foremost, that you're influencing the right people. Sometimes you have to influence decision makers who may not be, you know, in line with you on a lot of things, but they may care about clean water, or they may care about wetlands, you know, because of something that happened that they grew up on a wetland. You know, I don't know. There's just a lot of things that you can do to say, okay, this is the person I want to influence. And so I think of my work as sort of having multiple facets. More and more I'm thinking about things like policy, although my heart yearns to do more local projects. And so I'm trying to find that balance right now in my own work. It's not only documenting the beautiful, but also documenting the other side of the story, I think is super important. But, you know, like if you're wanting to do something locally, it doesn't take very long to go talk with local NGOs or, you know, sportsmen, people who are who are going out in the forest a lot, who notice changes, to figure out like what's changed in the last 20 years here. Like what good things have happened, but also like, did you used to notice more porcupine here or whatever that may be? And then begin to follow those leads and figure out what's happening. And sooner or later, you'll get to a piece of the puzzle that needs more exposure. And that's when your work really starts to shine.
Here is Morgan Heim from episode 13.
People are goofy. And I'm like, we present all these subjects in very serious ways. And sometimes that's what you need to do. But when you're out in the field with all these people, even on heavier subjects, like there's so many moments where there are accidents, people crack jokes, like we can't be heavy all the time. And laughter is, I think, a great unifier. And some situations lend themselves more to humor. And I really let the character kind of almost dictate the tone sometimes. So one example is with Deer 139. Like, it's like a comedy buddy film that's a conservation film. And I couldn't imagine being super serious with this film because these women, they are so goofy. Their personalities are just, you get through tough times with humor. And they are funny. They don't take themselves too seriously. To try to make a serious film would be disingenuous. So it just makes the process, I think, more enjoyable. And I think conservation photography is really fun. So I want to share how fun it is with people. And when it's the right subject to do that, I'm going to just fully embrace that. And it's really fun to just sort of see what transpires. It's fun to like cut loose and just be like, okay, we're not going to take ourselves so seriously. We're going to communicate important things, but that doesn't mean it has to be serious. It doesn't mean it has to be boring. It doesn't mean it has to be sad. It can just be a rip roaring good time. There's no reason why it can't be. Why wouldn't you try to do that if it seems to lend itself to that? One of the things that I do habitually is I appreciate all forms of art and photography, whether or not it has anything to do with journalism or nature or the environment. So I am looking at paintings. I am looking at sculpture. I am looking at fashion photography. I am looking at fashion. Like I am just in love with art in general. And I pay attention to the things that they do or the things that they do that I like. And then I think about, okay, I want to file this away because there's something here that I might be able to adapt to my photography for this subject. That's a huge part of the puzzle right there, because it just creates sort of like a little library catalog that will always just be living in the back of my brain that I can draw from. And then when I get into a situation, I think about how has this been represented before in other stories? You know, what is sort of the go-to tactic? And there are go-to tactics. And at one point they may have been very novel, but then they've become copied by people or just sort of like, this is what you do when you are faced with this situation. So, you know, a lot of people will photograph a bunch of items on a white back. This is not Meet Your Neighbors that I'm thinking of. But you know, like they might have photographed all the seeds on a white backdrop. It's kind of a scientific, you know, like you think about pressing flowers between paper, and that's how it's stored in these natural history collections. So we might think, oh, this is a science story. We'll put all of the food on white backdrops and do photos of that, and then we'll make a grid. And it's very, that to me is very scientific, and it's been used a lot, and it's perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with that. I knew I wanted to do something different with that same kind of information. So I wanted it to feel almost like that crossover between how we as humans would represent our own food and, you know, the wildlife diet. And because I want to create avenues in for maybe empathy. And I think there has to be something familiar in that experience to open that door. And so I was like, oh, you know, I love these paintings that are the overflowing goblets of berries and food and trays and things like that. So I was like, why can't we do that with the birds' diet? Like, I know no one's going to think, oh, this is how the birds get their food. I know no one's going to think like, oh, you know, she's anthropomorphizing. Like, it's just an artistic representation of a scientific fact. And it was so fun to do. And it was like, it was really exciting too, to see the researchers that I was working with be like, ooh, what are you doing? Oh, this is fun. Like, it was like they were playing, and it was fun to like break people out of their habits, and they're just playing with these ideas and with this thing that they're so familiar with. So, you know, we went on a little treasure hunt. We found all these, you know, these berries, this vine over here, and the head of the natural history collection at the UC Santa Barbara led us into the collections. And she was like, oh yeah, go get the lizards over there. And, you know, the deer mice over here. And we just made this like beautiful arrangement in this lab space. I brought, and it's kind of fun. It's like you bring all this random stuff on your shoot and people are like, what the heck? You know, I've got blue velvet and like a bunch of like dishes and goblets that I just like rummaged through my cabinets at home and threw into a suitcase. And we're moving lab tables around near windows. But it was like being a kid and playing make-believe, and it's like you're playing with your dolls again, but you're doing it with this really important purpose. And then you ended up with kind of a fun, unexpected image, which did not make it into the story, by the way, but that's because it didn't really fit with the context of the text. But I have this great photo that I can use for other things.
Here is Max Stone from episode 37.
Like, all these things were just coming together, and I started getting all these ideas. Okay, I can get this frame, that frame, you know, the way they monitor the bird's population, ARCI does. They fly fixed-wing airplanes over these roosting sites all over the Southeast, and they coordinate with different organizations to do it in different states. So they're all doing it on the same day so they can get a rough idea of the population. Well, I was like, great, I love aerial. So I love shooting aerials. So I knew I was going to ride in a plane with them to shoot that. But then I would like mount cameras on the dashboard to photograph Ken Meyer, like taking notes in his notepad, like remote cameras, you know, try and tell the story of what it looks like him doing his work. And then it was like, well, why don't we just hire another airplane? I'll fly over your fixed wing. I'll shoot you trying to shoot photos of the kites and get it all in one frame, which is much harder than I thought it was. But like, that's what happens, is the more you like get into a story, you start thinking of these frames. But the anchor frame that I kind of pitched the story on to Melissa, and she was really excited about, and I was really excited about, was a photo of a parent, so a male or female swallowtail kite, delivering prey to their young, like up at nest level, so 100 feet up. And she's like, oh, I love that. You can do that? I was like, yeah, sure. Well, yeah, we could figure it out. I mean, the biologists, you know, were monitoring using cameras, video cameras. I was like, I'm sure I can just do that. It was so much harder than I thought. And, you know, I had a limited time to work. Nests, you know, you only have a very short window where it's safe to do that for the bird's sake. Like, you know, you can't have a mother off the chicks if they can't thermoregulate. But then if they're too old, then you run the risk of them hopping out of the nest if you're up there. So very short window of time to work. So I, in order to do that, I'd never really officially climbed anything. Like, I mean, I've climbed tons of trees just on my own, just like hand over hand. But I hired an arborist to teach me how to climb, how to climb safely, how to climb trees. And so he came to my parents' house, which is in Gainesville, Florida, where there's a whole lot of live oaks and trees to practice on. His name is Drew Fulton, and Drew's also a great photographer and an arborist. So he taught me how to climb, paid him for a couple days to like feel comfortable, and then off I went on my assignment. And we're just climbing next to these biologists trying to make nice storytelling images of these birds. But that nest shot that I attempted never worked out. Not that summer. So the photos that get me excited are born from some random conversation. Like that's how it goes almost all of the time. And once you start visualizing it in your head and you start thinking about, okay, what are the challenges going to be? Like how possible? And if it seems like it's fairly impossible to make, that's when it starts getting really exciting. Because that's when you know that you've got like problems to solve, which is what I really enjoy. So I, of course, just enjoy like process. I love building things. I love designing things. I love just like the whole process of leading up to ultimately creating the image. And when you get it, it's exciting, but it's the whole thing leading up to it that actually really gets me going. So yeah, that's why I try to just talk to as many people as possible and not in this kind of like, ooh, what do you, you know, feed me ideas thing. It's just a conversation that ends up leading to ideas. I think a lot of times in the photographic world, we think we're on this like solo journey. You know, you're the intrepid photographer going after to document, you know, rare behaviors. But at least in my experience, I've never found it to be like that. It is always a partnership. It is always a collaborative effort, you know, to try to tackle something, whether it's with a landowner, whether it's with a biologist. You know, there's always some collaboration. And ultimately, that collaboration gives you some accountability. It gives me momentum, gives me energy. And ultimately, it helps to give your images legs too. You know, because you get other people to buy into that feeling and you get them excited about it. Like for the swallowtail kites, if Gina and Ken weren't into that, and if I was just kind of like, you know, please do this, please do that, that that shoot would have lasted 3 days and then been like, I'm done. But because we get excited, because we bring people into our world, I think that that ultimately is what leads to most powerful.
Here is Lauren Owens Lambert from episode 40.
Part of the next phase of that project is to really go out with the scientific community more and see what their field work looks like in terms of monitoring temperature and acidity levels and things like that. So I have to kind of start photographing more of the science aspect of the story, which is something I'm excited about. So it could be a really good opportunity to formulate a pitch and maybe reach out to some editors and be like, here's what I have. This is what I need. You know, are you interested? So I kind of think that's maybe where it's at right now. If the story is like 60% done, it could be a good time to reach out, but I'm sure every story is a little bit different. But I think going out and like collecting a few initial images, you know, making the contacts you want to make, just so you're not reaching out to the editors with nothing and with just an idea. Cause the idea is almost like the easiest part, you know, there's a lot of ideas out there, but you know, can you gain the trust of the people that you're going to be following? Are they okay with having you document their work or their life story or whatever it be? You know, so you have to kind of reach out to the initial subjects or characters that are involved in the story first, and then maybe follow them around, make some initial images, gather your, you know, your story synopsis and a few captions. And then, you know, and then where do you want to go from here? Like, what are you trying to do? And the story usually always changes or morphs halfway through anyway. So, you know, when you're 50 or 60% there, you can really like, you know, finish off the story and then maybe approach editors to be like, here's where I see this going. This is what I have already. Here's the quality of work. I have the connections. You know, are you interested? And if so, let's figure out a publication schedule kind of thing.
Here is Stephen David Johnson from episode 20.
You know, sometimes I think about this in terms of the short game and the long game. So sometimes in conservation photography, there's kind of, you know, the short game. There's a really particular issue that you want to address immediately. Maybe you're on assignment. I've done some work on raising awareness about pipelines that has very measurable goals and kind of a compressed timeline. This is a longer game for me. This is a long-term natural history passion project. And sometimes there are really measured goals that come out of it. For example, the pipeline that I mentioned is going to go within about 500 feet of a pool that contains a Virginia state endangered amphibian, the eastern tiger salamander. So by documenting that, I can feed that back to state agencies and give them a sense that, yeah, there are still these creatures that live here and they might be impacted by this industrial development. But probably the longer term goal is to impact a whole bunch of people who might never have thought about this particular environment. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be difficult to measure in the short term. Although I get a lot of feedback from folks who have visited exhibitions or seen my work online or contact me and ask, you know, can you take my kid out to see one of these pools? I think where the photographic aspect comes in is a lot of this stuff is just so hard to see from above the surface. And that's for a few different reasons. Amphibians live in this world that's just below the surface of the water. The meaning of amphibians means both live. So they're on the land, they're underneath the surface, but it's difficult to see below the surface. There's lots of reflections. Sometimes water can be a little bit murky. And then the stuff that I'm doing right now is on such a small scale that if you crouch down to see it at all, if you want to find one of these pools, the things look like specks. So I want to give people the sense that there's this really intricate, incredible world that's full of color and life and fascinating interactions that exist just beyond their front door, but maybe they've never been able to view it before. The long game ideas, you know, eventually there are going to be issues that come up around wetlands, developments, like the pipelines that I mentioned, development that's maybe more prosaic, like building homes, cutting down forest, draining swamps. I want people to be thinking about these images that they've seen and the kind of encounters I've had as they come up against those types of issues in the future. So in this particular case, I think I'm building a framework. I spend a lot of time in the field. I have the good fortune right now to be on sabbatical for my university. And my sabbatical project is fleshing out this vernal pools work. So I get to do a lot of field work that's not typically possible with my academic schedule. Mm-hmm. That means, I might go out for 8 or 12 hours and just wander around a pool. And this one late afternoon, I saw this frog who seemed kind of almost in a stasis, and it had buried itself on top of this egg mass like it was sleeping on this cloud. And it was such a remarkable, intimate little moment. I spent some time photographing it. So some of the vision, sometimes I'm able to pre-visualize things. Other times I come upon a moment and just start thinking about, how am I going to frame this or light this in a way that's compelling? Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, some of this comes in the selection process too. I might make 100 images and then decide, you know, what one really tells the story the best. And then it becomes about post-processing too. Mm-hmm. I spend a lot of time post-processing, often to do fairly subtle things, like think about, how am I framing the composition? How is light driving the viewer around the composition? And I would say in terms of inspiration for that, one of the people that I think of is Ansel Adams. You know, back in the darkroom days, Ansel Adams was working with a view camera. He would create these giant 8x10 negatives. And I love the way he would talk about them. He would say the negative is a kind of score, and in musical terms, right? And then the print is a performance. And I think about that now with my raw images, that the raw images are kind of like the musical score. And then the finished piece, which may be uploaded digitally or may become a print, that's kind of the performance. So when I'm doing post-processing, I'm trying not to move it into the realm of fantasy. I want it to still have this very concrete connection with what I saw before me. But I make a lot of subtle changes with dodging and burning to just even light out, to think about it in kind of a painterly way.
Here is Susie Esterhaas from episode 27.
You know, I think that one of the things about being a conservation photographer is two things. You know, I think that it's sort of hopefully in our blood to want to do something for conservation in a big way that, you know, we can look at awareness and creating impact with our photos. And I really wanted to take things a step further, particularly because I do shoot some visually, you know, flat out conservation projects, like particularly wildlife rescue. I've done a lot with that around the world and some other conservation issues, but a lot of my work is actually just natural history photography. And to me, natural history photography has always been more than just collecting pretty pictures. And it's been about doing something that with these beautiful photos that makes an impact. And for me, it's always been, I want to go a step beyond raising awareness and actually try to raise some cold hard cash. And so that concept has always been with me. I think it's my also earlier in my life, before I was a full-time wildlife photographer, I worked a day job for 6 years at the Santa Cruz SPCA. And my job there was, I was the events coordinator and also the public relations director. And so I had a huge part in our fundraising campaigns. So for me, fundraising became sort of something that I was very familiar with and had a lot of experience in. I know, like, the first year I worked for the SPCA, I was organizing this thing called the Mutt Show, which brought, like, you know, 500 people. And it was the majority of our annual budget was raised during these events throughout the year. And so that certainly helped. I think having that experience and seeing how things were done really helped. But I think really what it comes down to is that sort of innate kind of, it's in your blood. Like, I want to do something, and I want to do, and for me, it was like, I want to do something really tangible, and tangible for me meant, you know, funds. So that's kind of like where it all started in terms of my desire to raise money for conservation. And I started quite early in my career as a wildlife photographer to do that. And then, of course, as I got, you know, more and more established in the career, it actually became easier to raise money for organizations as I became more established.
I think when you build it in, it's also, if it becomes just a way of how you do things, and by no means am I saying everything I do, I give, you know, like, you know, my royalty checks that I get from my stock agents, like, that goes to me, that doesn't go to conservation. But a lot, you're right, a lot of what I do and a lot of my projects have a portion of the proceeds going to conservation. And when you build it into your business model, I kind of see it as like, you know, I've never really had, knock on wood, I've never had to advertise a lot. Like, occasionally I place ads for tours, but it's not very often. And I feel very fortunate that I haven't been. But when I have talked to people about advertising, what they've said is, you don't, you're looking at advertising the wrong way. You've just got to sort of build it into your budget, and it becomes like paying rent. It's like part of your operational costs. But I always look at advertising as like, I just lost $500 and I feel robbed. And so I think when we look at conservation like that, and instead of looking like, well, you know, there's $4,000 that I didn't make that I could have pocketed, I don't even look at it that way. I look at it as just like,
you know, it's part of the operational costs. It's part of the rent that I pay or something, you know? So I don't really even like put that many numbers on it. The only time I put numbers on it, to be honest, is when I want to feel proud. And I think that this is something that we should all do because I think it helps us stay optimistic and hopeful. I am very proud of the fact that I've raised over $200,000 for conservation, and I am very happy to brag about that. And I'm not a born bragger. You know, I was not raised in the social media world. And, you know, I was raised by parents, you be modest and very humble. But I'm not going to be modest and humble about how much money we've raised for conservation, because I think we need to be proud of our achievements in conservation because we're hitting our head against the wall so much. We need to celebrate our victories. And for me, that's my victory. And so that's when I put numbers on it, is when I want to feel proud of it, not when I want to look at how much I didn't pocket myself, which is, you know, easier once you become more established, easier once you don't have crippling debt to carry around. Was I doing as much for conservation when I had the $50,000 of debt like a ball and chain around my neck? No, I was doing some for sure. I was doing events and doing these prints and stuff like that, but I couldn't afford to do, you know, percentages and proceeds and stuff like that the way that I can now. So it helps to be, but having said that, you know, like, I mean, when I had that $50,000 of debt, that's when we self-published the Cheetah book and raised tons of money for cheetah conservation. And I wasn't looking at it as like, oh, that would have been great to pay off my credit card debt. I was just looking at it as like, we did this. This is awesome. And so I think it's the mindset too.
Here is Kika Tuff from episode 34.
Well, I think this is a really good time to be evaluating our flexibility and the skills that we have as a photographer and visual storytellers. Because, you know, I think on the surface, it looks like, you know, I know how to take my camera and create images that convey a mood or tell a story. But in that experience, you have actually accumulated all these other skills. So you've learned you've learned about composition, you've learned about color theory, even indirectly, you've learned about, you know, building drama in your images, and you've developed a sense of what resonates with people and what doesn't. And those are actually really valuable skills to go out and start to offer more to your clients. So I think strategy is one of these things that most nonprofits really need it. Your projects need it. You know, every scientist in a lab needs it, and they don't know it, but you can help them understand what strategy is. So you, as the photographer, go into the project and say, okay, you know, I know when I approach a photo story, I think about who is my audience and what is the purpose and what do I want them to do. So let's actually do that for your organization. Who is your audience and what do they care about? And how are we going to develop images that resonate with them? You know, suddenly you've taken the skills that you developed as a storyteller through photography and you've expanded them out. And now you're kind of serving as this strategist and you're adding all of this extra value to your work and to what you're offering the client. And I have found in my work, even when we start this process with the client and we use it to either build a website or make a documentary film, when I talk to the client later, they have said the most valuable part of the whole process was going through that branding stage and asking themselves, why do I do this? And who am I doing this for? And what do I want these people to actually do? That was in the end more valuable than the film that we made that showed at a couple festivals and that was it, you know? So I think we have all of these extra skills as a storyteller and we keep them in the realm of photography or filmmaking, but actually you can expand this into, you know, strategy that then you can take to anything. So maybe now, you know, we help some of our clients get on social media. And again, you ask all of the same questions you would ask while designing your photo story. you know, who's your audience and what do you want them to do and how do you want them to engage? Okay, you want an academic audience. I think you should start on Twitter. Here's the type of content that may be really valuable for you. You know, now you're a social media strategist. Okay, you know, given your expertise in imagery, now you have your social media strategy. Here's the types of images that you should have. Hey, I can create these for you. Let's put together a package where I do the writing and take the photos and manage 6 months of your social media activity. Like, it all actually starts with your skills as a photographer and a storyteller, but you can start to, with even just a little bit of self-education, you can start to expand that out so that when you approach a client, what they think they're purchasing is a series of photos. But what they end up getting is this entire discovery process and learning more about themselves and what drives themselves and their audience. And I have found that extra unexpected value is what keeps them coming back to say, I want to do that again. I want to think about this stuff more. I know I hired you for a website, but I just want to like be part of this process of self-discovery that you're facilitating for me. I want more of that. And so that's what I have found. It brings clients back for all sorts of crazy stuff. T-shirts, you know, I do like the kind of business cards. They'll sort of add anything on, I think, really to keep engaging in this discovery process. And those are the skills you've really been honing as a photographer because you've been asking yourself these questions and you've been crafting your eye for composition and mood and story. So you already have those skills. It's just kind of bringing them to a new place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes so much sense. All right. I hope that you enjoyed all of the insights and information and inspiration that everybody brought to the table during their interviews. I'm always so grateful to the folks who take time out of their day to come on the podcast and share their experience and their knowledge with us because we always learn so much from one another that helps us to accomplish these big goals that we have as conservation photographers. So a big thank you goes out to everyone highlighted here on this special Encore episode and to everyone who's been on the show so far. And of course, a big thank you goes out to you, the listener, because you are someone who is curious about conservation photography, who is curious about how to make a bigger impact for the planet through the passion that you have as a photographer. And that to me is a very big deal. So I am so grateful that you're here listening to this show. And just to make sure that you never miss an episode, if you could do me a favor and just take a moment to hit subscribe from wherever you're listening to the show, whether it's Apple Podcasts or Google, Spotify, whatever it may be, take a quick moment and tap the subscribe button. And that'll ensure that you never miss one of our episodes and that you always have information and inspiration at your fingertips. And meanwhile, we'll talk to you again next week. Thank you so much for listening to the very end of this episode, and I want to give you a reward for the attention and the dedication that you just showed. I have made something extra special for you. It is a 45-second quiz that reveals your unique personality as a visual storyteller. See, as photographers and filmmakers, we all have our own unique creative strengths as well as some weaknesses to be aware of. And this quiz will not only reveal your creative super strengths, but also provide you with a customized action plan to put those strengths into action. You can head to jamieh.com/quiz to find out your unique storyteller personality. That's jamieh.com/quiz. I hope that you have so much fun learning about the unique personality that you bring to your storytelling.